in the room. I'm Deanne Macias, and I don't have any relationships to disclose. And I'm going to be talking about a project which is it's a longitudinal project. It's community-based partnerships to access to care among limited English proficient Latinas in South Carolina. And to start, I want to give you just a brief overview of who the Latinas are in South Carolina. The majority are recent immigrants. South Carolina was predominantly a black-white state until about the mid-1990s, when we've had an influx of immigrants primarily from Mexico and Central America. Hispanics are the fastest growing population group in the state. You'll see that we've had a 400% increase between 1990 and 2006, and now our increase is primarily due to new births. The births to Latina women have up almost 656%, so we have a young population. Not quite half are female, because we do have a number of single males who are working primarily in construction and landscaping, but we also have about 45% who are women. Young, again, median age 26, and 41.8% report less than a high school diploma, so not a highly educated population, and the majority do not speak English well. Give you a little history. I arrived in South Carolina in 2000 at the time that the then governor had convened an ad hoc Hispanic task force. The census data was starting to be collected, and there was certainly an awareness that we had an emerging population. When I called around to find placements for students, people said, "We have these Spanish speakers, and we don't have anyone who speaks Spanish." So the governor's ad hoc task force looked at health issues, education issues, and public welfare issues. And I was on the health task force. And out of that, the report to the governor gave the priorities for Hispanic health. And what might you think they were? Language barriers, you taught. Okay, so whether it was prenatal care or workplace employment or hypertension or cancer, the real issue was language barriers, access barriers, cost, lack of data. We knew we had these problems, but we didn't know who the population were, because even the health department only had black, white, or other. So we didn't have data, but we knew that language and cultural competency and other barriers, such as transportation, insurance cost, were. So out of that task force, the 50 or so people who worked on that said, well, we don't want to just give the governor this report. We want to do something about it. So we created the South Carolina Hispanic Latino Health Coalition. And out of that coalition, the other projects that you see here, so for the past 6 or 7 years, we've been working on access to care issues. One of our first projects then was the Partnership for Cancer Prevention. We brought together Latino community-based organizations, cancer support agencies, healthcare providers, and some university researchers. We were quite a broad, multidisciplinary group. We were interested in what was going on, not only on the provider side, but also on women who would be trying to seek or would be needing to seek cancer prevention services. So the aim of the Partnership for Cancer Prevention was and still is to build and sustain partnerships and community capacity to address cervical cancer prevention and early detection for Latinas in South Carolina. We did that, again, looking at two issues, because when we talk about cultural competency, we realize that it's not only the cultural competency of providers, but it's also the issue of cultural competency of the users. And so we had partners, clinical partners, and they actually helped us design surveys, and they surveyed their own providers to understand their level of cultural and linguistic competency and the kinds of resources that they had. And this was a participatory project. The other side of that was to understand what the local Latinas' attitudes and behaviors around cervical cancer prevention and detection were. So with them, we mobilized our community outreach workers who knew the community, who had contact with women, and we conducted focus groups to explore their experiences and perceptions around cancer. We were interested in cervical cancer prevention and detection. What we found was that they usually didn't get those services. If they did, it was in conjunction with pregnancy-related care. And what really came out was that they didn't understand the U.S. healthcare system. I wonder why, because it's not a single-payer healthcare. Right. If they did access care, it was related to either pregnancy or some kind of acute care, not preventive care. And in getting information about the healthcare system, they rarely got it from the healthcare system. They got it primarily from informal networks. When they had gone to services, they often perceived that they had gotten second-rate treatment, and often that had to do with expectations. If you take a child to the emergency room for an earache, and you anticipate that you will get an injection for that child of an antibiotic, and you wait for 6 or 7 hours, and then you get the provider who says, take him home and give him Tylenol, the perception is, I was discriminated against, I paid much more than my friend who went someplace else and paid $60 for a visit, so I'm being discriminated against, and I'm not getting good care. I didn't get what I wanted. And then, of course, the usual suspects, there were the barriers of knowledge, language, transportation, costs. So we decided that, even though we were really interested in cervical cancer, we had to address access to care. And so we need like a U.S. healthcare system 101. What we did design was a curriculum. It was an English as a second language curriculum to be taught through ESL classes on how to navigate the healthcare system. It had 8 lessons around access to care, around patients' rights and responsibilities, that you have the right to an interpreter and you should not have to bring your own nor pay for your own interpreter. And then working on some of women's primary health issues, which include prenatal care, cancer prevention, and urgent and emergency care and primary care. So, to do this, we had to bring in new partners. We had to bring in ESL teachers and program administrators, ESL curriculum specialists, other Hispanic community members, the Medicaid administrators. This project was funded through Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they were interested in that aspect of it. And, of course, healthcare interpreters. So we had to bring more and broaden our coalition and our partnership. As I said, we have the Language for Healthcare Access curriculum, and the main aims of that were to increase healthcare access knowledge, decision-making skills, self-efficacy. I feel that I'm able to make an appointment. I know where to make an appointment. I know where to go. Trying to find the location and the bus schedules is a challenge in our area. We don't have good public transportation, but and then at the same time working on English skills. So we did, it was a randomized controlled trial that the curriculum was given through ESL classes in the community, and we did see that with this kind of curriculum you can have a change in access, knowledge, and self-efficacy. At the same time, we were doing other kinds of issues. The coalition had developed a cultural competency training, which we gave and provided to healthcare providers, social service workers, even police departments. This was a couple years ago. It was before the ICE raids. But we also developed a Spanish language for healthcare access project, which was the similar information about accessing care, but in Spanish. Actually, the results were similar. The one result that wasn't was that the items around I can access to care in English, or I have feel that I can use English, were of course different. And most of the people who participated in the Spanish language for healthcare access program were also taking English as a second language classes. We also, in the process, have been working to professionalize the language access services. In the early 2000s, most of the hospitals were using volunteer or ad hoc interpreters, very well-meaning, very well-intentioned. We now have gone more to the professionalization of language access. Among basic services, we still have a lot of problem with specializations. So women who need to be referred, those clinics don't have access to interpreters. These are all concurrent. You remember we've been working for a number of years on these projects. Our current project is the Iniciativa Latina Contra el Cáncer. It is an outgrowth of the Partnership for Cancer Prevention. We did get two community grants, and this is to the South Carolina Hispanic Latino Health Coalition. We're an entirely volunteer organization. But the American Cancer Society gave us a community partnership grant. We also got a grant through the South Carolina Cancer Alliance. And we have been now working on the really focusing in on access to cervical and breast cancer screening among Latinas. So we're doing that through three-pronged approach: community-based cancer education, mobilizing partnerships for community outreach and education, and improving Latinas' access to care, knowledge, and skills. So the community-based cancer education, we're doing radio spots, print ads, and a Spanish language community newsletter. We have done a cultural adaptation of a cancer education guide. The South Carolina Cancer Alliance has a cancer education guide. It's quite, it's very thorough. It's way too long. So, but they had it translated. So we've taken it and culturally adapted it. And then actually shortened it to focus in on breast and cervical cancer, because just going through the guide took like, you know, 50 or 60 minutes, and no one is going to sit through a 50 or 60 minute presentation in the community. We're using personal stories. One of the very first outcomes from our first project was that the Best Chance Network, which is our local breast and cervical cancer detection program, wanted to hire a Hispanic outreach worker. And they have been 5 years trying to do this, and they finally got this woman. Her name is Evelyn Lugo, and she's actually a breast cancer survivor. And so we're using her. I mean, we've had radio interviews with her. This is her story in Spanish. We're using her in the print ads. So again, a culturally sensitive and appropriate way to address prevention and early detection. We're focusing on action and access to care. We're giving out coupons so women can find out if they actually qualify for Best Chance Network. We've got cards, our sponsors, so we have some of the information about American Cancer Society. NCI has a Spanish cancer line, and our other local community collaborators. So through community outreach, we have just completed the training of some Latina promotoras or lay health workers. And what we have worked with them is, number one, understanding and navigating the healthcare system. Because we don't want to just say, oh, you need to have a pap test or a mammogram. And the first thing is, well, where, how, when, and how much is it going to cost? And that's a real challenge. But then using the cancer education guide, focusing on breast and cervical cancer detection and screening, and then where to go for available, affordable, cultural, and linguistically appropriate cancer services. We've developed a local resource guide trying to find where are the actual programs and services, and explain that Best Chance Network, it's not a place, it's a program. You qualify, and then you can go to these clinics, and you know what a sliding scale is. Again, a very foreign concept to anyone from another country. Finding out which clinics do have language access services, and then the promotoras have like flow charts, and they'll take, you know, how old are you? Do you have insurance or not? Do you, you know, have you had a mammogram or a pap smear? And then, you know, these are the places you could go. And then we give them a card that says, this is where the clinic is, this is the address, this is the phone number, and these are the kinds of things that they're going to ask you for when you go there. So we're just starting this part of it, but we're trying to give them the tools that they need. And we also talk about cost. And, of course, with the Best Chance Network, we're trying to get as many women on that program, because then they do not have to pay up front for the, they don't have to pay for the services. So overall, we are trying to provide linguistically and culturally appropriate information about the availability, accessibility, costs, and benefits of these services, and using lay informants in the community to transmit this information. Overall, we're also addressing the language barriers by providing trained interpreters. This is across the board. Working on provider-patient relationships and trust through cultural education and training through our coalition's cultural competency training, and then developing and maintaining community partnerships. We've been working for 8 years. We now, although the organizations are still in, sometimes people change, but we have those relationships developed, and we're able to work together and hopefully have some results to report in a future APHA. So thank you very much for your attention. I want to give you acknowledge our partners who've helped to fund the projects and participate in our projects. And there is my contact information. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Macias. Now we'll open it up to questions. You have been so patient. So if you have a question, go ahead.
Educating people how to navigate our
professionalization of interpreters, that is sometimes that's changing. But yeah, those are some of the barriers.
Yeah, I was mainly addressing community, people out in the community. You listen to the local talk show, radio talk show, and there's some real prejudice against serving the Latino community in public health. I'm not referring to the public health people. I am referring to the community and how racist it could be at times.
No, I mean, there's language discrimination is one of the issues, and I think that that's something we don't address very much in healthcare provider education. I actually designed a course on that I'm going to teach next semester on caring for limited English proficient patients, and I didn't say just for Hispanics or Latinos, but you know, limited English proficiency. So those are issues.
Do we have any other questions? Yeah, we are a little bit heavy.
I had a question. You had up there, you had at one slide, you had 53% said they had
a male,
and 53% also said they preferred. But
oh yeah, it's not necessarily
those
the same
were the
people.
Same,
it's just the same number.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's just the same number, which you know, it's the majority of both, which was interesting, I think.
But you did look later on at how many preferred a female but had a male.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a difference. I didn't point out the percentage. You know, that's in there. I can tell you.
I had a question for Project Lead and how you went about transferring that trust from all of the different member organizations to the broader group and earning the trust of the community partners. That you obviously have the buy-in, but what was that process like?
It's still in process, I think. I think a lot of it has been really giving folks the space to shape the agenda. So we're all volunteer-run, which I didn't mention. So none of our organizations up until recently we weren't fundraising for the project. It was, you know, I was just giving some pro bono resources, other organizations were giving pro bono resources. And because of that, we were able to say, hey, let's form an advocacy day committee or a policy subcommittee. And so folks really have been able to plug in where they have the expertise, resources, and time to shape the agenda. And I think that's really, for a lot of the partners, been what's been key. So the folks who are on the single payer or the incremental side of things are all in the policy committee because they know that they have the expertise there, and they're also going to be able to shape the agenda. Folks who are more community-based organizations are doing the leadership and training component now because that's where they have the expertise and really want to shape how that work moves forward. So I think it's been a really organic process. I think the challenge moving forward, now that we're actually securing foundation funds just for this project, will be to continue to maintain the ability for groups to plug in and shape the agenda and not have it be this kind of executive committee we form doing a top-down approach. So everything's been really grassroots up, I think, which has been the success of really getting buy-in from folks.
Okay, well, since we don't have any other questions, I'd like to thank all of our panelists again for taking their time to share all the hard work and the research that they're doing, and it really speaks to the diversity of women's health issues and needs and the progress that we have made. So thank you all for coming.
Okay. Women, yeah. 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 Well, good. So you don't back to
Did you know Bobby? I had a student did it for